what we've been through is horrible. I mean, we're stuck inside, yeah. and you know, we can't shake hands, and we can't have a beer normally, and the economy is all gone to shit, and all those type of things. But at the same time, mm-hmm. look what's happening around us in terms of the ecosystem and the environment of healing, and we should continue that momentum of healing into the future. I mean, that's my hope.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Tim.
And I'm Stacey.
And welcome to We're Not Doomed,
the podcast all about the human nature crisis that we're facing and what we can do about it in the Caribbean. This week, we are virtually traveling to Bonaire to have a chat with the interim director of the Dutch Caribbean Nature Alliance, Tadzio Barefoots. We talk about a whole range of topics, which can be best summarized as the many wonders of the environment in the Dutch Caribbean, but also the complexity of managing these invaluable resources. He shares his journey, which started at having a love for diving and tagging sharks, to becoming the face of one of the most crucial nature management organizations in the Dutch Caribbean. We love his down-to-earth and balanced view about the challenges we face and the work that needs to be done. Despite these many complexities and often being overwhelmed by this, he remains optimistic that we are not doomed. Let's go to our conversation with Tadzio. So maybe we can begin with a bit of information about you. So can you maybe introduce yourself to the podcast listeners out there?
Sure. My name is Tadzio Barefoots. I am the interim director of the Dutch Caribbean Nature Alliance. The Dutch Caribbean Nature Alliance, or DCNA, is a network organization that provides support, support in terms of capacity, but also in terms of financial support. And sort of policy support to the park management organizations throughout the Dutch Caribbean. So as part of our board of DCNA, we have representatives from Tinapa Bonaire, Tinapa Stacia, the Sabre Conservation Foundation, the Aruba National Parks Foundation, Karmabi Curacao, and the St. Martin Nature Foundation. So that's basically what DCNA is. And before I took up my position at DCNA, I was the director at the St. Martin Nature Foundation, which is the organization responsible for park management on St. Martin.
Right.
Nice. How did you become involved with all of this work?
Well, my undergrad was actually in the background of international relations. So I come from a governance and policy background for my undergrad. When I graduated with my bachelor's degree, I found myself as, you know, a 24-year-old guy co-owning a dive shop.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, starting, you know, being involved in the dive industry since I was more or less 13 years old, I saw in front of my eyes a change in especially the marine ecosystem on St. Martin.
Right.
Yeah. So I... So when my partner, who we were running the dive shop with together, when he decided to move to New Zealand with his family, I decided to further my education in the Netherlands, focusing on resource management, and then specifically on sort of the marine aspect of resource management. After I graduated, I was engaged in a project in Bermuda. From Bermuda, I lived in Africa for quite some time, which I, you know, where I always also was engaged in a marine conservation project. Then I became marine park manager in Stacia. And then while my sort of role in Stacia was coming to an end, I was asked to kind of reinvigorate the St. Martin Nature Foundation and at the same time establish the marine park. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Cool.
Yeah.
So did you always know you wanted to go into marine conservation, I need to say, or, you know, be involved with nature since you were a kid?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was one of those nerds growing up where, you know, sharks and dinosaurs were my obsession.
Nice.
Dinosaurs kind of went extinct, came to my obsession, but the sharks kind of remained.
Right.
So
just, you know, barely extinct.
Yeah.
So I kind of always knew that I wanted to, you know, be involved in some way or the other. In some form of conservation, marine conservation, mm-hmm. or nature conservation in general. I'm also, you know, an avid diver, although I dive a lot less than I used to, especially in working diving. So, yeah, I mean, I guess the natural sort of evolution of my interest in my career has resulted in me, you know, being really significantly involved in the conservation world in the Dutch Caribbean.
Yeah, nice. I think Tim can relate to that as well.
Yeah, definitely. for sure. Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting to hear how you made this change in what you were doing, starting off with resource management and then completely into marine biology and conservation. Right. What is it that you see as the greatest threats to the marine and coastal environments, and especially also the people that utilize these areas?
I mean, there's a few. I mean, to rank them, I think, would be a disservice to the sort of myriad of threats that are out there. Of course, the sort of traditional ones, such as unrestrained coastal development, poor urban planning, not putting enough effort into sustainable use of the resource. All of those sort of, you know, traditional longstanding conservation issues are now further compounded by issues related to climate change.
Mm.
Yeah.
So we see a significant impact on, you know, our ability to, at the same time, do effective resource conservation, but at the same time also responding to these climate change events. And then now, as we live in this age of pandemic, the resources that are made available for us to respond to these events are now dwindling before our eyes. So I think, you know, if I were to put it succinctly and in a nutshell, I would say just a general effort and the focus on nature conservation is kind of, you know, the main challenge when it comes to addressing the issues that we face.
Mm-hmm. When you say there's like a lack of effort, could you define that, please?
I mean, the lack of effort is definitely not in terms of the organizations that are doing excellent work with critical resources. But I still think that, especially on a government level, so on a higher policy level, when it comes to our decision makers, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. the link has not been sufficiently established between the need to develop sustainably, which also, of course, includes the management of our natural resources, and how important that is for the economic development of our small island developing states. So I think the challenge for us is to really communicate, of course, to our decision makers, but communicate also to the wider public, so to the general public, the importance of conserving their resources. Of course, on some islands, it's easier than others. For example, on Bonaire or Ceiba, just to use an example, you have a smaller population that's quite sensitized to the importance of nature conservation. But mm-hmm. on some of the islands that are larger, that have a more tourism-based economy or infrastructure, such as Aruba and St. Martin, it's a little more of a challenge to bring that message across.
Right.
Yeah, because people tend to think it's all about money sometimes, at least, you know. On policy level.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, the bottom line is what's the most important here. And hopefully as we kind of sort of emerge out of this lockdown that we've been in for the past few months, and as we now struggle with the sort of economic considerations of the effects of the pandemic, hopefully we can now move into a more sustainable way of planning our economic future, which also includes, of course, the sustainable use of our resources as we move forward.
Yep.
Yeah. Do you think this pandemic can provide some kind of boost for us to reshift our thinking and viewing of these natural environments, or at least on the level of the government?
Well, I hope so. I mean, granted, the immediate concern right now is to ensure the health of the general population.
Right.
And also the, you know, the financial considerations with so many people losing their jobs, businesses closing down, the complete disappearance of tourism. But hopefully hopefully we can also rephrase in terms of the national development plans for the islands or the various governing programs, that we can include the lessons that we've learned from this pandemic to, on the one hand, diversify our economy to not mm-hmm. depend solely on cruise tourism or mass tourism as is being done on many of these islands, but to also consider, you know, the natural use of our resources, or the use of our natural resources, sorry, and to sort of maintain and enhance the goods and services that those resources provide.
Right. Because what I always find very interesting, and obviously a paradox as well, I mean, these islands are so dependent on tourism, yet it's probably one of the more polluting industries on these islands because of all the, you know, the waste that might not be managed well. What were the things that you saw regarding to this? Like, I remember that you did a lot of tests of the water quality, that kind of stuff. What did you get out of that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, we're all guilty in one way or another. You know, we also are tourists and we also visit countries that are sensitive, you know, especially in terms of interest, visiting countries that have sensitive habitat. But what I think is important to note is that especially mass tourism, and, you know, I don't want to always, actually, I do want to focus on cruise tourism. That has really a significant impact in terms of the environment. While at the same time, the revenue which is generated from industry, such as cruise tourism, does not generally find itself redistributed in the wider community.
No.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right.
Go ahead, Steve. No, I think you're making a valid point there because, I mean, I'm very critical on the one hand towards tourism too, but I think it's the type of tourism that we're looking
at.
And especially in the Caribbean, you know, it's the mass cruise tourism or, you know, also the all-inclusive resorts, stuff like that, that is, I think, more damaging than other types of tourism that can even bring in more revenue.
Right. No, and definitely so. I mean, the sort of two, you know, examples that I use or that I have been using over the past couple of months is St. Martin versus Bonaire. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only mm-hmm. in terms of environmental impact, but also as part of you know, the impacts of COVID-19. If you have a country that really focuses on mass tourism, that focuses on cruise tourism, which, you know, if you were to ask me, the Florida Caribbean Cruise Association, which is sort of the overarching body of the cruise industry,
right,
where it basically dictates the government and health policy of the islands leading up to the corona crisis. You know, that ranges from, you know, forcing countries to allow crew and passengers to disembark, not canceling cruise calls. Whereas on Bonaire, the decision was taken quite early to close off the borders to especially mass tourism. You can really see the discrepancy in how the response has been vis-a-vis the different islands. I mean, on St. Martin, mm-hmm. you have a situation where you've had 17 deaths and 70 odd cases, whereas on Bonaire, we've had two very minor cases that were able to recover quite quickly and very minimal impact on the overall healthcare of the island. The other hand, you know, having worked on St. Martin for almost a decade in the environmental field, you know, we've dealt with issues such as cruise ships dumping pollution, sewage in the water. We've dealt with cruise ships discharging their waste, so their solid waste on the island, an island that already was struggling with their solid waste management to begin with.
Yeah.
And the unfortunate thing was when I came to Bonaire in October 2019, I saw that there was a trend to kind of court the sort of mass cruise tourism industry model that was being used on St. Martin and Aruba specifically for Bonaire. So I hope this is the opportunity for especially islands such as Bonaire that may have been considering embarking on a close relationship with the cruise industry to really reconsider that and put the focus more on a sort of, I mean, I don't want to sound elitist, but on a more affluent, higher income bracket type of tourist.
Well, the bigger spenders, yeah,
exactly.
I guess.
That, you know, appreciate more staying in an eco resort or that come here specifically to use the environment, such as, you know, diving is a big example, bird watching, for example.
And
so I hope that's the opportunity that comes out of this this whole mess.
So tourists with a lesser footprint, ecological footprint.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
No, but I also like, you know, you mentioning, it's just kind of sad as well, you know, seeing cruise tourism taking flight. And it also surprised me looking at the development sometimes taking place on Curaçao, because, you know, I'm from Curaçao and I've been following the developments a bit from a distance. But, you know, when they built the second mega pier and destroyed, you know, a lot of the coral reefs, and now you have those hotel brands cutting down mangroves. Right.
Crazy.
I honestly can't wrap my head around it. You know, what are people thinking? Like, that's something that, and I'm the environmental psychologist here, but I just don't understand, because to me it feels like such common knowledge that this is harmful and and damaging. And I still ponder sometimes, like, what are we supposed to tell these people? How can we, what are we supposed to show them to convince them that what they're doing is just ridiculous? You know, what can we do to convince them otherwise?
Yeah, another result that I hope comes out of this is more significant reliance on science-based decision-making when it mm-hmm. comes to our policymakers.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope they take into consideration more, you know, the advices and the sort of recommendations coming from, especially the science, the conservation science community, when, you know, we sort of give recommendations as to how a certain development should be taking place. The need for environmental impact assessments, because that's also an issue on especially the three constituent states within the kingdom.
Is it mandatory?
Mm-hmm. St. Martin. No, it's not mandatory.
Right.
I mean, I'm speaking of St. Martin specifically.
Okay.
For example, when I was working at the Nature Foundation, I was often asked to do environmental impact assessments. And I was like, no way. I mean, an EIA is something that companies specialize in. And, you know, whichever development has to happen, the developer has to pay a specialized company to give a, you know, objective environmental impact assessment report as to whichever development mm-hmm. Is coming. And that is not something that has been captured in the law quite the way that it should be, so to speak. So I hope as we, you know, as we turn into a quote unquote new age coming out of this mess, that, you know, there's more of a focus on you know, that sort of decision making that incorporates you know, the scientific data in terms of what the impacts will be on the environment, and then subsequently also on the economy.
Right. Business as usual is not where we want to go back to. And would you say that, like, having policy with more inclusive investments, and what I mean with this is like taking account of the environment more, not chopping down mangroves to build a resort or anything, this should be the new kind of policy? Is this?
Yeah. I mean, that should be the new norm. I mean, oftentimes you hear national governments bat around sustainable development without knowing what sustainable development actually is. I mean, if you look at sustainable development, it consists of three pillars. So sustainable environment, you know, sustainable use of natural resources, sort of sustainable economies and sustainable social safety nets. And, you know, without one of the pillars, the whole concept of sustainable development completely collapses.
Mm.
So I hope this is realized moving forward, and that's, you know, I mean, not to sound overly optimistic or utopian in any way. I hope that will be the way that, you know, our economies moves forward.
Yeah.
So some optimism is definitely not a bad thing.
No,
gotta
no,
stay
never.
Positive, man.
And I mean, it's I mean, in our line of work, I think it's critical to have that
exactly.
That sort of optimistic outlook, or else you'll burn out and be a bum for the rest of your life. I mean, sometimes it's you know, one step forward and two step backwards, but you know, you have to continue stepping forward, or else you know,
exactly.
You're in the wrong line of work.
To be fair, though, I think there are quite a lot of environmentalists that have come across this problem where they just can't wrap their head around it anymore, and it drives them insane. I think we've all been there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me personally, it's my job, it's my work. I mean, it's my profession to be in this field, but I mean, it's also something that I feel passionately about.
Right.
And you know, that caring and that sort of compassion that you have for nature and the people that depend on it, when things go wrong, it you know, it happens that I stay in bed for the rest of the day because I just can't. I can't adult mm-hmm. on a specific day. So
yeah.
But it's important to remain positive and to use the sort of successes that we've had over the past few years to use that as sort of the motivation to move forward.
Yeah. No, I think we all kind of need to have the mentality that giving up is just not an option. Even though it can be super overwhelming at times, especially knowing what we know and seeing, you know, what's happening on a local but also on a global level. So maybe kind of moving on and going a bit more in depth into ecosystem times. Do you have a favorite ecosystem?
Well, I mean,
do you have a favorite kid?
Yes, my dog. I mean, mean, my background is the marine ecosystem. I, you know, it's what I'm, I wouldn't say most, well, yes, I'll say that it's the ecosystem that I'm most interested in. Of course, mm-hmm. I realize that, you know, especially on these small islands, you can't talk about the marine ecosystem without including the terrestrial ecosystem because,
yeah,
you know, with basically all coastal ecosystems here on, you know, in the Dutch Caribbean.
Exactly.
But, you know, if I had to, if I had to, you know, choose my favorite one, it would be coral reefs. But I must say, last Friday, I went on an excursion into the mangrove forests of Bonaire. And, you know, it might be equal, if not slightly higher than my previous favorite ecosystem.
Awesome. Could you tell us a bit more about that tour?
Yeah, so there's a mangrove activity center here on Bonaire that does a really well-organized and, you know, enlightening tour of sort of the mangrove forest here on Bonaire. Previously, I've worked in mangrove ecosystems on St. Martin, definitely. Barbuda, I was involved in the reforestation project of the mangroves there after Hurricane Irma. Mm-hmm. Before I used to be more exposed to mangrove habitat that was severely degraded. But, you know, being in the mangroves of Lac, you know, such dense mangrove forest, tunnels that are completely covered in canopy, we had the opportunity to snorkel as well, encountering, you know, mangrove snapper, parrotfish that are eating algae off of mangrove roots, which I've never seen before.
Wow.
Turtles, you know, it was really a magical experience for me. It was awesome.
Awesome. We mentioned this just prior, but we know exactly why it's bad if a resort chops down a whole mangrove forest. But could you explain to the listeners why mangroves are so crucial?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of the importance or the goods and services that the mangrove ecosystem provides, I mean, it cannot be understated for countries that have them. I mean, of course, if you look at an island like Ceiba that has no mangroves, it's a little bit different. But for the islands that do, you know, mangroves provide a nursery for critically important fish species, including commercially important fish. Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. act as a natural filter for water. So usually mangroves are located in catchment basins, and before the water enters into the ocean, it is filtered through the mangrove ecosystem. But I think most importantly, and for me, you know, what highlighted, you know, those goods and services most critically is the experience that we went through of Hurricane Irma in St. Martin.
Yeah.
So St. Martin, as a background, cut down about 85% of its mangrove habitat in the Simpson Bay Lagoon and in the Oyster Pond area.
Wow.
85%.
It's insane.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's crazy. And most of it was done to accommodate hotels, resorts,
of course,
marinas, you know, infrastructure that supports the sort of mass tourism that St. Martin was departing on or has departed on. At the same time, the few remaining mangrove strands that we did have in St. Martin when Hurricane Irma came through in 2017, we saw that the areas with mangroves had a significant reduction of the level of storm surge that was recorded. So in one area where there were mangroves, we saw a storm surge of about a meter.
Wow.
And then another area where they cut down the mangroves and, you know, the hurricane and bore the full brunt of the hurricane, they saw a storm surge about 5 to 7 meters.
Wow.
So it's quite significant in terms of the coastal protection function that mangroves provide.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, as we discuss in terms of climate change and the need to adapt to the impacts of climate change and sea level rise, you know, one of the most effective adaptation mechanisms is to ensure that the coastal protection function that mangroves is being maintained and enhanced.
Right.
Yeah. Are they working on replanting mangroves now in St. Martin?
Yeah, so the two organizations that are most active in that are Environmental Protection in the Caribbean, EPIC, mm-hmm. and the Nature Foundation, of course. And right after the hurricane, both organizations supported each other quite significantly in mangrove reforestation. And those projects are still ongoing.
Excellent.
With the funding of the World Bank and sort of the focus on the recovery of the Simpson Bay Lagoon, which used to be the largest enclosed lagoon in the Northeastern Caribbean before they filled it all in. Mm-hmm. Mangrove reforestation is high on the list. Because, you know, people also saw that, you know, the areas that were completely denuded of mangrove forests were trashed,
right.
Whereas the other areas were able to weather the storm, intended.
But... Yeah, I was just wondering about that, if the government kind of drew those conclusions themselves too, yeah. When they saw the damage and the difference.
Well, I do hope so. I mean, we for sure... made a significant point of it in pointing that out also in a Dutch national media. Mm-hmm. As to how important the ecosystem is. But yeah, I mean, those things are ongoing and hopefully they will continue to happen.
Yeah.
Hey, and what kind of investments do you think are necessary to realize these healthier coastal environments, as many are like highly polluted or damaged or denuded of mangroves, as you said?
Well, I think the Dutch Caribbean is a little bit unique in the rest of the region in that conservation and conservation management and the protected areas and the management of protected areas are mandated out to NGOs,
yeah.
Which can be a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, if you're part of the government apparatus, you're more or less sure of continuous funding unless something happens in terms of the national budget. So the challenges for NGOs is to secure sustainable financing. That's always been the issue. But on the other hand, these NGOs are often, in fact, the staff of these organizations are all very passionate people that care very much for what they're doing. So I think that's very much a benefit. But the investment needs to be put into the organizations to be able to execute their jobs more effectively or increase the effectiveness of their jobs. And not only for the protected area management organizations, but also for DCNA, of course, is to come up with a challenge to find a mechanism that makes protected area management sustainable for the islands. Of course, DCNA manages a trust fund, and that trust fund is dispersed annually to all six of the parks. But at the same mm-hmm. time, it's also what we feel the responsibility of the governments to adequately fund nature conservation through the park management organizations on the island. So that's really right. Where we have to put the most of our efforts to get that type of support from the governments in recognition of the important role that these organizations play. Generally in the economy of the islands, you know, because I mean, resources that these organizations are protecting is, you know, it's part of the product that these islands are trying to sell in terms of tourism.
Exactly.
In terms of the goods and services that ecosystem provides. So that's the most challenging part. I mean, I wish I could spend all my time tagging sharks or planting mangroves, but unfortunately I spend quite a bit of time together with my colleagues here and my colleagues on the board of DCNA to and with WNF, and can't forget them because they're also giving good support in finding sustainable mm-hmm. finance mechanisms for the parks to continue to do their work.
Yeah.
Cool. Because what types of activities need to be funded for the parks, to the parks?
I mean, they range from being able to put fuel in patrol boats, for example, to patrol the marine protected areas, to having a education and outreach officer on staff, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it runs the gamut. I mean, many of the parks and DCNA also, we are engaged in quite a bit of projects.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, many of these projects don't really provide operational costs or costs for overhead, for example. So mm-hmm. the challenge is to really capture the need for the operational costs so that the work can be done.
Yeah.
So basically a lot of labor.
Yeah, labor.
You
know, make sure that the staffing is correct. I mean, for years on St. Martin, being so busy the way that we were doing everything with just four people on staff. So,
yeah, that's insane.
So so much work has to be done. So that's really the hope that the money reaches where, I mean, it's unfortunate that we talk about money when we talk about nature conservation, but it's inevitable. So
mm-hmm.
the hope is that you know, that funding reaches where it's supposed to reach.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing, something that I find kind of silly also when talking about nature. So I need to finish it still, but I started watching this documentary called Making Profits from Nature. Mm-hmm. And just the title made me cringe.
Yeah, it is.
Yep. I saw it.
Because it's horrible. You saw it?
Yeah, I think one of the worst things you can do is hang a price tag on certain natural elements.
Yeah.
It is not a smart thing to do.
On the other hand, if that is something that becomes an incentive for investors or companies that are causing also damage or, I don't know, you know, governments to pay the price. So, I mean, I still need to finish the documentary, but I think it's weird always to think about money and nature. But sometimes I'm also thinking, well, maybe we need to rethink and revolutionize or the way we view the environment to create bigger incentives for people, even though the biggest incentive is just that we can even breathe our lives. So that's just kind of the paradox.
To give you a little bit of context, though, on that documentary, it's about offsetting damage to biodiversity. So basically, a bank can buy biodiversity certificates for so and so much money, and then they can completely destroy a system and then offset the money that a smaller area is protecting.
No, that's not that's not the kind of money that
I think it was a 20 billion yearly, like $20 billion yearly thing. So it's insane, especially in the States. They use this.
And it's crazy, but it's very true.
Yeah, it is.
When I first started at the Nature Foundation, where I had a specific task to make sure that the Marine Park got established, I went into a meeting with a specific minister, won't call no names, and he told me point blank to my face that money talks and bullshit walks.
Right.
So that kind of gave me the incentive to go actually out and, you know, to go out and actually do sort of economic valuation on the ecosystem that we wanted to protect. And then afterwards, when we came up with a dollar figure saying, you know, the goods and services that the coral reef ecosystem provides to the economy of St. Martin in terms of beach replenishment, recreation, coastal protection, all of that came up to, I think it was 50 million a year or something like that. And it's only then when we were able to show that the ecosystem provides, you know, an X amount of money in terms of goods and services to the economy of the island that they even considered establishing the marine park.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. Yeah. I mean, you know, sort of these offset costs are worrying, but at the same time, especially in terms of being able to communicate the importance of the resource to those that are not necessarily involved in conservation in general, it is a good tool. And then also on the other hand, if you have an idiot boat captain that runs into an X amount of section of reef, we're able to give them a bill for the restoration.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think this would be an entirely different discussion for another podcast.
Yes.
Final point I want to make is that what I meant, at least, again, I haven't finished watching the documentary, but what I meant is not to offset the environment or nature, but to indeed have some kind of monetary value placed to it, but that it's only of value as long as it's there. So you cannot replace it with money, just to kind of, you know, say it's only of value if it's going to be there. If it's not there, then you're like declining exponentially, to present it in a way like that.
And now I'm going to be really annoying. How do you determine how much a hawksbill turtle is worth compared to a single clump of brain coral?
I don't know. With that, you need to talk with all those ecosystem valuation.
I mean, there's different methods to do it. I mean,
yeah, of course.
Also, you know, choice modeling.
Yeah.
And the willingness to pay model.
Bequest value and all of those sort of esoteric ways of valuing the ecosystem. But in our communication, we made it clear that the value that the ecosystem provides is how it is in its intact state.
Exactly.
And if it's not in its intact state, the value will drop. And if it's enhanced or restored to a higher level, then of course the revenue will
increase. Right.
So exactly. it's part of framing the messaging for those that consider bullshit to work.
I was just being annoying, and like I said, this is a whole different discussion, but a very interesting
into another episode. For sure.
So we've talked about some of the kind of negative aspects. What are some of the really positive actions that you're seeing right now?
Well, I mean, right now on Bonaire, for example, there's a very strong movement to do things sustainably as we come out of this crisis. So it's encouraging to see, you know, the discussions happening, the plans being thrown around. What we're working on now together with WNF is to make sure that those good ideas and that momentum that we've been having for the past few months, that it is crystallized, that it is solidified in some way. On St. Martin too, we're seeing an increased awareness of the importance of a circular economy, the importance of small-scale backyard agriculture, the impact that invasive species have been having on trying to, you know, plant something in your backyard.
The monkeys.
The monkeys eat the common iguana. And, you know, for me personally, I mean, I don't know if it's a figment of my imagination, and it's also something that we're working on to see if we can actually quantify that, is the capacity of healing that that the ecosystem or that the environment has if humans will just take a little bit of a break. So, you know, here on Bonaire, you know, I've been seeing fish that usually were very skittish because of the amount of divers are coming right up in your face. In the Simpson Bay Lagoon on St. Martin, the lagoon has never been as clear, has never had as many sea turtles as it has been having recently. So I hope that we can use that momentum to move forward. And like I said, I mean, all these organizations have people working in them that have as a central goal and a central passion to conserve the environment. So that's cool. What's been making me very...
No, I just really had to laugh at your comments about the fish not, or being less scared when you're diving. Because that is, you know, I've worked with fishermen, especially on Bonaire a lot, and that was one of the most mentioned remarks from the fishermen when you would ask them if there were less fish in the water and why. They would say, well, yeah, the divers are chasing them away. They're scaring them off. So now that you're mentioning this, like, oh my God, are they right? Because everybody would always laugh in their faces saying, well, that's just lunatics and we're not chasing them away. But I always said, well, they might have a point. I don't know.
So could be an element of truth in there.
Yeah.
I mean, in my experience dealing with fishermen, you also, I mean, you always apply the 20% rule. It's either 20% larger, smaller than what they actually think. But I find, generally speaking, I mean, these are guys that spend most of their time out there, and they have a sort of visceral connection to the environment they work in. So I tend to take what they say quite seriously. So
same here.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, funny.
It could be. In any case, I've never had a snapper, for example, come right up in my face when I'm on open circuit scuba. Usually, when I'm on a rebreather, they would react differently. But I've been on open circuit scuba diving, doing some work in the last couple of dives that I've been on, and it's crazy the amount of fish life and the vibrancy on the reef.
Cool.
I really hope that people realize that, you know, with just a few, with some effort, we can reverse some of the environmental damages that we've been doing to our island ecosystems over the past few decades.
How are the different organizations communicating this revamp of nature in these times to the general public?
Well, I mean they should, and they are. Of course, there's more capacity on some of the islands to sort of do communication and outreach than on other islands. But I think most of the islands, or most of the organizations that are operational on the islands, are really highlighting the fact that what we've been through is horrible. I mean, we're stuck inside and, you know, we can't shake hands and we can't have a beer normally, and the economy is all gone to shit and all those type of things. But at the same time, look what's happening around us in terms of the ecosystem and the environment of healing. And we should continue that momentum of healing into the future. I mean, that's my hope.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Do you have an optimistic message for the listeners as we will close off?
Phew. I always struggle with these kind of ending statements. No, I mean,
putting you on the spot.
Yeah. My hope for especially island residents, but also for the listeners in the Netherlands or in Europe or in the States, I always tell people that they need to realize that living here and being able to visit these islands is a privilege. It is a privilege because we are surrounded by the environment that we're surrounded by. We live on some of the most, we live and visit some of the most beautiful places on earth, and it's beautiful because of the environment. And to really put effort and support the organizations that are working day and night tirelessly, often with very little salary and very little support, to protect and enhance the environments that are so useful to the to the economies of these islands. So, yeah, I mean, you know, when outside opens back up, I hope everyone takes the opportunity to enjoy it. I mean, even going to the beach is using our natural resources. So enjoy it responsibly. It's a tough situation that we've been in, but we can learn very valuable lessons from what we've been through the past few months. And let's carry that momentum into the future, into making our unique part of the Dutch kingdom sustainable and green/blue.
Nice.
Yeah. And I also think, just to add to that really, really beautiful message, is that this pandemic has also shown us that taking drastic measures is not impossible.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when required, I'm just hoping that we will be able, as a world, but also as an island, to do the same again.
Yeah, definitely. Here.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you so much for your time and all your cool insights and stories.
Yeah, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Glad you invited me. It's been an honor. And I look forward to hearing some more interesting podcasts.
Yeah, we'll be asking way more people.
Well, I mean, awesome. We understood it. Sounded good. And cheers for everything. We really appreciate it. And it was good hearing from you and a lovely chat.
Yeah, for sure. And we connect when we're able to go back to the Netherlands.
Definitely. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. I'm hoping I could come over to your side of the ocean, to be honest.
Well, whatever.
Let's see. Cool. Let's see when the borders will open up again.
All right.
Okay. Hey, have a nice day. Say hi to everybody at DCNA for me.
All right. Cool.
Awesome.
All right.
Thanks, Tatio.
Cool. Right. Speak soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Alright guys, we hope you enjoyed this conversation with Tatio. We sure did, and we always learn a lot from him. Next week, we have another speaker lined up, so we will hope you will tune in. But for now, have a nice weekend, and until next time.